It's the NPR News Update on Monday, May 12th. I'm Phil Picardi. Coming up on the podcast, Vapors Caution Against the Regulation of Electronic Cigarettes. State Capitol reporter Tim Pugmire talks about what's left for lawmakers as the legislative session winds to a close. Breakfast in some Minnesota schools appears to be yielding results, and Twin Cities Theaters of Color combine forces. First, Minneapolis residents with opinions on whether the city should ban plastic foam cups and takeout containers will have a chance to weigh in on the issue today. Curtis Gilbert reports it's an issue with a history.
Minneapolis first tried to ban plastic foam 25 years ago. Local grocery stores denounced the proposal in radio ads.
Do you realize that Minneapolis will become an island?
Well, great. No more traffic jams.
No. An island of high food prices and red tape.
The ordinance passed anyway, and then council member Steve Kramer predicted it would have a big impact.
The days of the styrofoam egg container are numbered.
But the egg cartons and other foam products survived. The broadly worded ordinance was never enforced. Since then, more than 100 U.S. cities and towns have passed bans, and Minneapolis is taking another stab at the issue. And even though recycling has made huge advances since the late 80s, most plastic foam still goes in the garbage. The new proposed ban only targets foam containers at restaurants, though, so those egg cartons would still stick around. Curtis Gilbert, Minnesota Public Radio News.
The U.S. Senate could take up a bill this week that would change the Affordable Care Act to give employers an incentive to hire veterans. Elizabeth Stawicki has more.
Starting next year, businesses with more than 50 full-time employees will have to provide health coverage under the federal health care law. It's been unclear whether veterans will be part of the count if they already have separate government health coverage for military personnel known as TRICARE. The legislation would clarify that veterans don't count towards the 50-worker threshold. Supporters call it a fix in the law, which they say would remove any disincentive to hire veterans. But it could give employers a new reason to take on veterans if hiring them would keep the employer under the 50-person minimum. A procedural vote on the Senate legislation could take place midweek. Elizabeth Stawicki, Minnesota Public Radio News.
On Mother's Day, Governor Dayton signed the Women's Economic Security Act into law. Among its provisions, stricter enforcement of equal pay laws for businesses contracting with the state. Matt Sepik reports.
Starting in January, businesses with more than 40 employees seeking state contracts worth more than $500,000 must prove to the state human rights commissioner that they provide equal pay to men and women in the same job categories. Senate Chief Author Sandy Pappas, a DFLer, says employers may still consider different levels of education and experience.
If the commissioner audits and finds out that those reasons are not at play, then there's a negotiation process that would happen with the business.
The new law also extends unpaid family and sick leave from 6 to 12 weeks and expands unemployment benefits to sexual assault victims. The measures won bipartisan support, but some Republicans said the equal pay bill could discourage businesses from bidding on state contracts. Matt Sepik, Minnesota Public Radio News at the Capitol.
Electronic cigarette users are firing up their devices in all kinds of places people would not consider lighting a conventional cigarette, and that has inspired moves in the Minnesota legislature to regulate vaping in the same way smoking is regulated. But some people who inhale nicotine mist say it's harmless and a far cry from smoking. They say government regulations are not necessary. Mark Zadeklik reports.
Walk into Morrissey's Irish Pub in uptown Minneapolis puffing on an electronic cigarette, and the bartender will ask you what you want to drink, not tell you to take your vaping outside.
It's not so much that they're welcome as they haven't been an issue so far.
My name is Paul Crilly, and I'm the general manager of Morrissey's Irish Pub. We don't get a lot of it, but as I say, if we do, we just let people go ahead. Nobody has complained.
But vaping is as big of an issue as smoking for some people. That's why many businesses prohibit e-cigarette use, the same way they restrict smoking. E-cig users say there's no evidence inhaling vaporized nicotine is unhealthy. Critics say no one knows about potential risks because no long-term studies have been done. Inside the Tavern Grill in Woodbury and six other Hemisphere Restaurant Partners establishments in Minnesota, vaping is not allowed.
Time to time we had people who sat at a bar and enjoyed their e-cigarettes, and we kindly asked them to enjoy it outside or on the patio.
Anoush Ansari is a managing partner of the restaurant group.
In a restaurant setting, I don't see it appropriate.
Ansari says over the 6.5 years since Minnesota banned smoking in bars and restaurants, people have become accustomed to smoke-free environments. He says it doesn't really matter whether it's actual smoke or concentrated mist. He doesn't think his customers want to be around it.
Even though you can really smell it, but it's just the gesture that I think a lot of guests kind of don't enjoy anymore.
Even so, Ansari says he thinks deciding whether to allow e-cigarette use should be up to businesses, not the government. And that's essentially been the debate at the Capitol. The House position was to ban e-cigs in schools and prevent kids from buying them. In the Senate, there was a move to treat them like cigarettes and ban their use in indoor public places. That's the approach the American Lung Association in Minnesota supports, says spokesman Bob Moffitt.
We're not advocating that e-cigarettes be totally banned or, you know, or made illegal. What we're asking is that, or what we're suggesting, is that e-cigarettes have the same common sense regulations that we've used for regular cigarettes. It just makes good sense.
But e-cigarette users take issue with the comparison to conventional cigarettes. At an e-cig store and vaping lounge in Bloomington called Smokeless Smoking, a few e-cig users stand around a bar and talk about their favorite flavors.
Captain's Custard is always good, but I think I may have vaped myself out of that too because I went through quite a bit of it.
We're not smoking anymore. We don't smell like smoke anymore. We're not blowing smoke into the air anymore. So we don't want to be treated like smokers.
That's Matt Black puffing on a homemade vaporizer with a flavor he's really into, which he says tastes like Andes mint.
I want to say it's like spearmint with vanilla, probably French vanilla, and maybe some chocolate. I don't know, but it's fantastic.
Black is the president of the Minnesota Vapors Advocacy Group. It formed less than a year ago in hopes of heading off legislation to clamp down on vaping. Black, who's 32 years old, says he quit smoking conventional cigarettes the day he started vaping about a year ago, and he says he's not alone. He says allowing individual businesses to make decisions about allowing e-cig use is a matter of public health. He says many e-cig users would go back to regular cigarettes if they had to live by the same rules as conventional smokers.
Our group is fighting to try to convince the state not to put in regulations that prevents people from quitting smoking.
And that fight is far from over with the exploding popularity of e-cigarettes and the growing health concerns about their potential risk.
Mark Zedeklik on the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. State lawmakers have just 1 week left to finish their work and adjourn the 2014 session. House and Senate negotiators still need to reach key compromises on bonding and supplemental spending. They also need to resolve competing medical marijuana bills. Governor Dayton has been offering some end-of-session advice to legislative leaders on all of those issues. Tim Pugmire talked about the session's homestretch with Kathy Werzer this morning.
So let me ask you about Governor Dayton. He said he would be willing to sign the medical marijuana bill that the House passed on Friday. Does that mean that medical marijuana will pass and be signed this session?
Well, it looks like it's headed in that direction. The question remains whether or not this House bill in its entirety is accepted. The Senate could do that, but it doesn't look likely. Governor Dayton made it clear in that letter to lawmakers on Friday that he feels the House language better addresses the concerns of stakeholders, and he would sign that version into law. And of course, this is a big step. He has not made such a pledge before. So there's a path for resolution right there, but DFL Senator Scott Dibble, the author of the Senate bill, sent a lengthy response to Dayton yesterday. He said he thinks the House bill falls short in a number of areas, and he thinks a middle ground can be found. So look for a conference committee early this week.
That should be an interesting conference committee, too. So what about the bonding bill? Where's that?
Well, private talks are underway among the DFL bonding chairs in the House and Senate. Also, the lead Republicans on the two committees are involved, and they're trying to reach a compromise agreement on the specific public construction projects that would be in the final bill. And a deal, a prearranged deal like this, would mean each body would only need to vote on it once. The Senate finally came out with its proposal last week to compare with the earlier plans from the House and Governor Dayton. DFL leaders have set the amount of the bill at $846 million. The projects need some Republican support to pass, but this additional $200 million cash allocation for some bonding projects does not need Republican support. On Friday, House Speaker Paul Thiessen and Senate Majority Leader Tom Bach both said that they would get involved in these negotiations if an agreement isn't reached soon.
Okay. Now, are lawmakers getting close to an agreement on the supplemental spending bill?
Well, DFL leaders agreed on an overall spending target. It's $293 million, but we still don't know exactly how that will get divided up among the various budget areas. Some things are certain, like that 5% funding increase for the home and community-based health care programs that we've heard so much about this session. Other things, though, not really clear at this point. Governor Dayton also weighed in on this. He sent a letter to legislative leaders last week saying that he thinks their proposed spending is excessive by about $30 million. Should mention also one of the factors slowing down the bill a bit is the need to reflect whatever comes of the medical marijuana issue, and we won't know that until that issue gets resolved.
You know, just listening to you here, Tim, we have bonding, supplemental spending, and medical marijuana. This seems like a lot to do in just a week. Can they get it done?
Well, everybody seems to think so. You know, there are lots of balls in the air right now, but Senate Leader Bach said he thinks they're still on pace to finish early by a couple of days. Paul Thiessen, the House Speaker, not quite as optimistic. He said Friday that it's never happened in the 11 years he's been in the legislature, and he's not really sure that an early adjournment is going to happen this year. But if things fall into place right, it could all come together fairly quickly this week.
All right. I know you'll be keeping track of it. Thanks much.
Thanks a lot.
Tim Pugmire and Kathy Werzer on Morning Edition. And, of course, morning is a good time for breakfast. And Kathy introduced Tim Post's piece about the importance of kids getting a nutritious breakfast.
Quick question for you. Did you eat breakfast this morning? If not, you're likely to pay the price in just a few hours from now. You'll probably feel a little tired. Your stomach will start to rumble, and you might get a headache. But for students in school, hunger can be a serious problem.
I love seeing these kids getting nutritious breakfast. It means a lot.
St. Paul's schools and other districts across the state have found ways to get more students to eat a good breakfast. And the results are showing up in the classroom. Tim Post has our story.
Dawn Fair works the morning crowd entering Capitol Hill Magnet School like a hot dog vendor in a ballpark.
Eggs for breakfast this morning. Hot egg.
Fair, who's a nutrition assistant at Capitol Hill, meets students at the front door with a plastic bag they can fill with food. Second grader Dylan Toohey takes her breakfast right into class.
I got a cinnamon toast crunch, it's right here, and I got a orange juice, citrus sun, refreshing juice, and yeah, 100% orange with calcium and all that.
Most days, almost half of Capitol Hill's 1,300 students grab a breakfast to go. That's about 600 students. A few years ago, when free breakfast was served just to low-income students in the cafeteria, only 90 would show up each morning. Offering free breakfast to all students at the front door gets a lot more takers, and it ends the stigma for low-income students who may not want their friends to know they qualify for a free breakfast. There have been other changes at the school as well. Before the Breakfast to Go program, school nurse Betsy Garcia would see about 10 students each morning complaining of a stomach ache. Now there are only a few a week. Garcia says that's because more kids are eating breakfast, and she's seen a number of other improvements.
We also looked at variables related to behavior, to cognition, memory, participation in the classroom, attendance, and they all had improved once the children had consumed breakfast.
For students, hunger can cause problems in school.
So a student is sitting in the classroom, they're trying to learn, but every part of their body is telling them, you need fuel, you need food.
That's Angie Gazik, a nutrition specialist with St. Paul Public Schools. Gazik says hunger is a distraction for students. It can make concentrating on something like a word problem really difficult. That's because their body keeps interrupting with messages about finding food.
A train leaves the station at 6 p.m., traveling west at 80 miles per hour.
Hey, it's your stomach.
I need some food.
Track,
hey, it's your brain.
3 hours later,
I need some food.
West,
hey, it's your muscles. I need some food.
At what time will the second train catch up with the first?
That's the distraction hunger presents to a student. But there's a physiological side as well. Like gasoline fueling a car, food fuels a body. Specifically, it's a sugar called glucose that comes from digested food. Without enough glucose, students' brains start to slow down.
When kids don't have breakfast or they haven't had a meal for a long time, they don't have enough fuel to actually get the brain going.
Krissa Arkan is a nutritionist and a research associate at the University of Minnesota Medical School. Arkan says a hungry student is not ready to learn.
They might be sluggish. They might be irritable. They might be not attentive.
She says they also can't concentrate and their memory suffers. For years, researchers have known students do better in school when they're well-fed, especially when they have a good breakfast. Arkan says access to a school breakfast program can improve students' behavior and their grades.
Studies have found that 2 to 3 weeks of regular breakfast intake improves academic achievement in the long term.
The federal government started the school breakfast program as a pilot project back in 1966. But school officials today continue to work on the best way to get breakfast to students. The University of Minnesota is currently studying free breakfast programs in a number of schools in greater Minnesota. Within a few years, researchers hope to better understand how handing out free breakfast to students once they walk in the door changes their day.
Tim Post on the NPR News Update. The governor's fishing opener was held over the weekend to mark the start of the walleye season. And tourism officials have announced next year's fishing opener will be held in northeastern Minnesota. The Lake Vermilion Resort Association will host the event beginning May the 7th. Natural resources officials say fish populations in many Minnesota lakes weathered the state's harsh winter. DNR Fisheries Chief Don Pereira says the exceptions are shallower lakes in western and southern Minnesota, but he predicts populations in those lakes will rebound relatively quickly.
We will get them restocked. Those lakes are also very, very productive, so when we reestablish fish in those lakes, they grow very rapidly. And in fact, some of those lakes, after they win a kill, we can stock walleye fry and have pretty spectacular walleye fishing within a couple of years.
Pereira says walleye populations are plentiful in most of the state's lakes. The Walker Arts Center in Minneapolis will present 5 world premieres and a wide selection of artists as part of its next performance season. Curator Philip Byther says the dance, theater, and music performances touch on everything from human relationships to quantum physics. Byther says he's looking forward to a February performance by the Campbell Brothers, who perform gospel music on steel guitars.
And they're going to celebrate the 50th anniversary of John Coltrane's A Love Supreme, played all on these sacred steel string guitars. So that's the actual month that Coltrane released that record on Impulse Records, but done in this beautiful other way.
The Walker season begins in September. 5 Twin Cities theaters of color are forming a coalition to engender respect for their communities on the stage. The move comes as theaters nationwide are struggling to adjust to changing demographics. It also is a response to recent incidents in which communities of color say they've been offended by the work of local theaters. Marianne Combs has more.
The coalition consists of Penumbra Theater, Mu Performing Arts, New Native Theater, Teatro del Pueblo, and Pangea. By joining forces, the companies aim to broaden cultural perspectives in the local theater scene. Sarah Bellamy is the co-artistic director of Penumbra Theater, which specializes in staging stories of the African-American experience. She says it's important for theaters to consider the impact of their productions on the whole community.
There's a difference between Black theater and plays with Black people in them. One has a social justice imperative that deals directly with the community. The other uses those people in ways that are not always beneficial to the community.
Penumbra Theater has a close working relationship with the Guthrie Theater, which regularly presents Penumbra productions on its stages. But a few years ago, the Guthrie hosted a pre-Broadway run of the musical The Scottsboro Boys. In it, a young Black man was depicted tap dancing while being electrocuted. The show's creative team was white. Again, Sarah Bellamy.
it's really, really important that people of color be consulted about the ways in which our cultures are being represented on American stages. The stakes are too high right now.
Bellamy says racial tensions have increased nationwide since the election of President Barack Obama. On top of that, the population in the Twin Cities is changing. According to the state demographer's office, people of color make up about 25% of the Twin Cities' seven-county metro area. By 2025, that segment is expected to grow to 30%. But the increase in diversity doesn't necessarily translate to an equal increase in representation on stage. Randy Reyes, artistic director of MOO Performing Arts, says when stories about a culture are only told occasionally, it's important those stories don't perpetuate negative stereotypes.
I see the negative effects on my community and the community at large. It's just it's painful for everyone. And it breaks my heart that the very thing that I feel like should be the catalyst for conversation and change becomes the issue.
Reyes says the Twin Cities theater community needs to help Minnesotans discuss race frankly, rather than simply react to difficult situations as they arise. But a new coalition of theaters of color might not have much of an effect on an organization like the Ordway Center for the Performing Arts. President and CEO Patricia Mitchell says the Ordway regularly presents diverse companies in its World Music and Dance series. But, she says, when it comes to theater, she's restricted almost entirely to what Broadway touring productions are available.
Just look at the ad page in the New York Times. That is what, a year from now, some of that will be what we will have to choose from. In terms of influencing what, in quotes, makes it to Broadway, which is what, in quotes, makes it to the touring circuit, frankly, we have very little influence.
Even when it co-produces a show, Mitchell says, that often translates to financial support, not artistic input. However, the Ordway may have a financial incentive to reevaluate its theater season. Vicki Benson, arts program director with the McKnight Foundation, says increasing diversity is changing the funding priorities of foundations across the country. They want to support organizations who view diversity as an asset.
In a community that is changing, being relevant means listening to the entire community and responding.
Benson says remaining relevant will keep Twin Cities arts organizations strong in the future. Sarah Bellamy says the new coalition is meeting monthly and will soon begin reaching out to other theaters in the Twin Cities.
I think people are scared to be collaborative. I think they're scared to let other people in. And I think we need to do whatever we can to change that for the future. We have to talk to each other.
Bellamy hopes that the new theater coalition will help facilitate a necessary and difficult conversation about race.
Marianne Combs on the NPR News Update. Thanks for listening to it today. I'll be back with Tuesday News on your schedule right here tomorrow.